This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, September 19th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums in our studio in Fayetteville.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda in downtown Bentonville. Support for KUAF comes from the Community Clinic, helping people lead healthy lives by providing health care in Northwest Arkansas for over 12 years. Locations in Springdale, Rogers, Siloam Springs, and Fayetteville. Healthy people, healthy community, on the web at communityclinicnwa.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we continue our series on poverty in Arkansas with a look at some of the historic reasons the state has battled a higher poverty level than most other states for decades.
And a new effort to increase the number of people with college degrees in the region. Five area institutions are working together to try to convince adults to finish the work they began on campus but didn't complete.
First, John Brown University in Siloam Springs announced yesterday that it is the first college campus in Arkansas to become a zero landfill institution. Steve Brankle, the college's director of facilities, services, and sustainability, said the road to zero landfill use began about a year ago when the university reassessed its roughly 20-year-old recycling program. After meeting with the city of Siloam Springs and businesses in the city, he says that the college took a number of steps to increase the amount of waste being recycled, first increasing the types of materials the college could recycle, and also dispersing more recycling bins across campus. But he says that was just part of the strategy.
The other thing that was really exciting is the faculty and staff got on board with a program where my custodians no longer empty their trash. We will empty and sort what they recycle in their office, but then they're responsible to take their trash to a central place in their office area. When they realized was how much trash they actually have versus how much recyclables, they got off great. I went 8 months without emptying my trash can in my office because we can recycle so much.
Brankle says that while some recyclable material will always end up in the trash, none of the trash now generated by the campus ends up in a landfill.
We have two trash compactors. The big one that most of the campus trash goes to, we compact it. And then when that compactor's full, the city of Siloam Springs hauls it over to Tulsa, along with some other businesses in town that are zero landfill. It goes to a zero emissions energy plant, and they incinerate the trash, and they generate steam and electricity. And like I said, it's a zero emissions plant, so it's totally green. So nothing's going in a landfill. You could argue that we're hauling it to Tulsa, but that's about 30 more miles than we used to haul it, but it's not filling a landfill.
In addition, Brankle says that food waste is sent to an area hog farm, and the renewable energy major program at the college even recycles the used cooking oil from the kitchens at the campus. The oil is converted into biodiesel, then used in campus lawnmowers. John Brown University says it has even found a way to divert from the landfill items that would normally be thrown in a dumpster on student move-out days.
The Salvation Army approached me last year and just said, hey, we'd like to be a part of your move-out procedure. If there's clothes, furniture, half-empty shampoo bottles, whatever. We would love to have them. There's people that need it. What are you doing with it now? And a lot of that stuff, honestly, I had to tell them, it goes in the dumpster. They were just like, gosh, we could help you with that. We could take a lot of that off your hands. And we did it last year for the first time last spring, and we got plans to do it bigger and better this year.
Brankle says that going zero landfill is just one part of the college's sustainability approach. He says that another project the school is working on would involve using gray water from the city's water treatment plant next door to irrigate some of the landscaping on campus.
A new high school opened in Lincoln this fall, and as we reported, traffic was initially an issue in front of the school located on Highway 62. Traffic was so much of a problem that Lincoln police officers were stationed in the area to help direct traffic during the first few days of school. One of the reasons for the traffic issues was that the stretch of highway in front of the school had yet to be declared a school zone. But Joe Shipman, engineer with the Arkansas State Highway and Transportation Department, says the problem has been remedied.
The school zone was warranted to be a 25-mile-per-hour speed limit when children are present, and those signs were installed a couple of weeks ago. They have asked about permitting for placement of flashing beacons on their advanced school signs, and we have responded back to them and are waiting to see if they want to proceed with that. It would be warranted if they so wanted to do that work.
Shipman says if the district wants the warning lights for the school zone signs, the city will have to pay for them, and the necessary traffic signal permits would be issued to the city. Shipman says investigators use a variety of data in determining whether to designate a school zone.
The investigator visited the area, observed traffic in the morning and in the afternoon, both on separate days, I believe. and evaluated the traffic, the speed of the traffic, and other issues involving congestion, pedestrians, observed traffic turning in and exiting from the school.
In addition, investigators look at state law and the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, a national publication about implementation of traffic signage. Arkansas is going to beef up in its fight against prescription drug abuse thanks to a $45,000 federal grant from the National Governors Association. Ed Barham of the Arkansas Department of Health says prescription drug abuse is the fastest growing form of drug abuse, a fact that's all the more important considering that Arkansas has the second highest rate of drug overdose deaths in the U.S.
This grant lets us work with other states and with the national experts to really develop something that we think will make a difference. We need to develop a plan for cooperation among the more than 300 agencies at the federal, state, and local levels, the private agencies as well, so that we can really get some traction against the problem.
Barham says the money will go toward drug abuse monitoring and enforcement, as well as destruction of unused prescription drugs.
The city of Fort Smith will play host to a delegation from China next month. According to thecitywire.com, a delegation of 9 municipal officials from the Chinese city of Jing will pay a visit to the city October 3rd and 4th. It's a city of about 8.3 million people with strong mining and manufacturing industries. The delegation will first visit Little Rock, where it will attend the Clinton Presidential Library and have lunch with Governor Mike Beebe. When the contingent makes its way to Fort Smith, it will reportedly visit the National Historic Site, tour a local manufacturing plant, and attend a meet-and-greet session with the public at 6 p.m. October 3rd at the Fort Smith Convention Center.
Tonight's weather forecast calls for clear skies with a low in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, expect clear skies, but with a 20% chance of rain and a high in the low to mid-80s. Tomorrow night, we'll have partly cloudy skies. In northwest Arkansas, there's a 30% chance of rain with a low in the upper 50s. In the Arkansas River Valley, there's a 20% chance of rain and a low in the lower 60s. This week on Ozarks at Large, we have been discussing poverty in Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Ithiagni Hotrimadulker has been talking to experts, advocates, and social workers to get to the root of Arkansas's poverty problem. Today, we find out why Arkansas has been so chronically poor and how the poverty problem affects all of us.
Here's something you might find interesting. Go to the Google search engine. Type in, why is Arkansas? And wait till Google autocomplete offers suggestions to complete or finish the sentence. One of the four suggestions that pops up is, why is Arkansas so poor? Dr. Michael Katz is a poverty historian at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and author of the book, The Undeserving Poor, From the War on Poverty to the War on Welfare. I asked him, why have Arkansas and the American South been so chronically poor?
Well, it's part of the underdevelopment of the South as a region historically, going back to slavery and the failure to industrialize until late, the kind of staple economy, a lack of the union movement to take root there. The South, you know, really was, until after the Second World War, in many ways, the nation apart in terms of its social structure and in terms of its economy. And a lot goes back to the history of a plantation economy that ran on black slavery.
Over the years, several other causes have emerged. Rich Huddleston, the executive director of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, says one of them is the structure of a state's economy.
You know, what kind of jobs do you have in state? What do those jobs pay? And so so states that, quite frankly, have more advanced economies with more of a high-tech economy, that have more jobs, that pay better, the residents of that state are less likely to be in poverty than in another state.
Huddleston says a state's economy is also directly correlated with education.
If you look at states that have high levels of education, in states where the college attendance and graduation rate is high, those states tend to have less poverty than others.
He says Arkansas has made impressive progress in the field of education in the past decade, but still has a long way to go when it comes to college graduation rates.
Because we have far too many people who go to college who, quite frankly, are just not prepared to succeed in college. And if you're in that situation, chances are you need more remedial courses while you're in college. And the more remedial courses you need means it's going to take you longer. And it also means that you're less likely to graduate.
Huddleston says that according to research, for a state's residents to find better jobs, investments need to be made early on.
Kids who are born into poverty and who spend the first few years of their life in poverty, they tend to be at greater risk in terms of not being prepared to succeed in school. In part because their families are poor, and so they may not get good access to health care while they're young. They may not have all the family resources that it takes to really help a young child grow up healthy. They may not have enough books in the family. And it also may just mean that their parents themselves are not very well educated.
Leah Hamilton, assistant professor of social work at the University of Arkansas, says there are several vicious cycles at work in Arkansas. Because the state has an insufficient number of college-educated residents, it does not attract a sufficient number of well-paying jobs with benefits. So, when Arkansans do earn a college degree, they often leave the state to find employment. The other vicious cycle, Hamilton says, is that programs aimed at helping the poor do not encourage savings and financial independence. For example, the current asset limit to avail temporary employment assistance program benefits is $3,000, which leaves a family with very little safety net for future emergencies. Another factor that plays an important role in determining a state's rate of poverty is minimum wage. The state's current minimum wage is $6.25, compared to the federal minimum wage of $7.25.
If you've got one parent working in a four-person household, or even two parents working, that's not going to get you to the basic amount you need to get by. So as we said, citizens generally agree that it costs a family of four about $40,000 to pay for basic needs. And even two incomes on minimum wage is not going to get you there. So just raising that to even half of the median income would significantly increase quality of life for a large number of citizens.
The median income for households in Arkansas is close to $39,000. So, what are the effects of poverty? Rich Huddleston from Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families says that poverty directly impacts health and education outcomes for the people living in it. Poor parents are also much more likely to pass on poverty to their children, thus perpetuating the cycle of poverty. Finally, there is the economic cost of poverty to the state.
If you look just at the economic impact of kids living in poverty, it results in the loss of about $6.2 billion to the Arkansas economy each year because of things like lost economic productivity, because of expenses associated with crime and running a juvenile justice and criminal justice system, and then also just the amount that you have to spend on healthcare issues later for adults. And so poverty imposes not just costs on those families directly impacted by poverty, but it hurts the workforce, and it just hurts the overall economic well-being of the state. And we're all hurt by poverty.
But when it comes to finding a remedy for poverty or investing resources to overcome it, states and the federal government always cite a lack of funding to do so, Michael Katz says. The poverty historian from the University of Pennsylvania at Philadelphia says the idea of cutbacks and shortage of resources makes him very impatient.
This country is incredibly rich. It's awash in resources. And it's really a question of how we handle those, how we want to distribute them. You know, whenever we want to do something, whenever we want to fight a war, for instance, whenever we want to invade Iraq or have a prolonged war in Afghanistan, somehow the money is there, right? But when it becomes a question of, say, the money so that we could cut the number of children and live in poverty in half, have enough money, like the city where I live, Philadelphia, to fund the school system decently, then, that money just doesn't exist.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large's series on poverty, we meet Casey Bird, a single mother of two who is living below the poverty level.
It's been up and down. I have always worked more than one job. I do cleaning as well. I've done some commercial cleaning, and I clean people's houses. And I still do massage and skincare. I have little massage parties or facial parties, some on the side. And so I've always had to carry more than one job to be able to keep things afloat. So it's always been a struggle, but I guess it's in how you look at it.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
If you have any comments or suggestions, please let us know. Email us on ozarksatlarge@gmail.com or visit the Ozarks at Large Facebook page to tell us what you think.
And this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums in the Anthony and Susan Hoy newsroom at KUAF. Antoinette is in downtown Bentonville to cover an announcement to be made today by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. We'll have more about that on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. If you've been paying attention to the news for the past few years, it's not a surprise that Arkansas and Northwest Arkansas trail behind other states and regions when it comes to the percentage of population with college degrees. Governor Mike Beebe says it is a top priority for the state to increase the number of degree holders. And last year, when the Northwest Arkansas Council identified problems challenging this region, the lack of adults with college degrees was near the top of that list. Yesterday, the Northwest Arkansas Council, five institutions of higher learning, and others unveiled what they hope is a way for people with some college experience to finish their degree.
So why are we doing this? It's simple. We know that 25% of people age 25 or over in our region have a bachelor's degree or higher.
John Brown III is the chair of the Northwest Arkansas Council's Educational Excellence Work Group. That 25% figure he mentioned is lower than comparable regions. Trailing in that category, the council says, hurts the region in several ways, including attracting possible employers to the region. Yesterday's announcement was to go public with a website, graduatenwa.com. Several partners think that this can lead adults back to college easier. That website is aimed at a specific target audience.
We also know from the U.S. Census Bureau that 22% of all people aged 25 or over in Northwest Arkansas have some college credit, but no degree. It might be 10 credits or 50 credits or 90 credits, we don't know, but we'd like to see how many of these people we can convince and then assist in completing their degree.
John Brown III says it also puts residents in a better position to obtain better jobs. The website is just the beginning, a gateway to a system that will connect those interested in going back to school answers to their questions. It also gives the website visitor a real person to talk with, a real person like Lori Walker, an admissions representative at John Brown University in Siloam Springs. A few clicks on the site takes you from the main page to her contact information. She says being able to connect to a person can make the idea of going back to school, in some cases years after leaving, less intimidating.
Historically, university websites are a little challenging to navigate, especially for adult students, because they're built for the 17-year-old student. And so we wanted to give them someplace that they could go get basic questions answered. Every single one of the five institutions has a person listed with contact information so that they can reach out for if they have additional questions.
The other participating institutions are the University of Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas Community College, Northwest Technical Institute, and University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences Northwest. Those five formed the Northwest Arkansas Higher Education Consortium and have worked in tandem to put together the website. Keith Peterson, the Vice President of Instruction at Northwest Technical Institute in Springdale, says the coordination between the five institutions, each with a slightly different approach to higher education, will create more options for people seeking to complete a degree.
You know, from our perspective, it really legitimizes the role that technical education plays in today's economy. Really, this is a group effort for Northwest Arkansas. You've got five schools who are all swimming in the same direction, and our goal is to reach as many people as we can and educate the population in Northwest Arkansas. I think for our institution, it really validates that there's a sort of an alternative option to a traditional education, that if you want to do that. In today's economy, a lot of people need to go to work right now, and NTI is the aspect of this group that really allows a very short transition from school to workplace.
I first went to school after I graduated high school, went off to college, and wasn't quite prepared for what lay ahead of me, so...
The graduate NWA website includes clips of success stories from adults who had to stop their college education, then continued later. Phil Jones tells his story in those clips, and he was at yesterday's launch of the website. He says he went back to school when he had two daughters, ages 5 and 7, a 40-hour-a-week job, and an active life with his church, and when he needed more than 90 hours to finish his degree.
And I took about one class a semester for two or three semesters, then increased that to two classes a semester, and sat down one day and looked at my course catalog and thought, hey, this is going to take another 5 or 6 years to finish up. And it did. It was a 7.5-year journey. But really, time goes by in school or out of school. Why not be in school and just finish school?
He says the completion of that degree came at an important time. Within a year's time, his then-employer sold the division he worked for. He says with degree in hand, he had far more options than he would have had otherwise. Within months, he had been hired by Nabholz Construction for a far better job. Phil began his quest to complete the degree in 1994. And he says in the 18 years since his return, colleges and universities have become much more aware of the needs of the returning student. Don Crandall, Vice President for Enrollment Management at John Brown University, agrees. He says JBU's degree completion program uses what he calls a cohort style that makes the return to studying a better experience.
How we do that is that they start with 20 or 25 students and they go through the entire program with the same 25 students. And so they become kind of a family. I think that's one of the challenges that, you know, students think, well, the only option is for me to go one class a semester and it may take me 10 years to finish this up. There are other options out there. So in our program, I think, provides another option for people that they're still doing life. They're working, they have a family, you know, they're active in their community, and they don't want to disrupt all those things. They have to keep working and with their family. So that our program allows them to be able to continue to do that as well.
The new program is also sponsored by the Arkansas Department of Higher Education, the region's five largest chambers of commerce, and Tyson Foods. The chair of the Tyson Board of Directors, John Tyson, says for his company to be part of the concept is a matter of common sense.
You know, this is the focus about how do we get educational development integrating with the business community, because rest assured, I was told the other day we had like 160 opens in what you call college management jobs. I know our friends at J.B. Hunt or at Walmart or some of the other organizations in the area need folks too, because we talk all the time. And the vendor community itself needs ongoing graduates to make a difference in Northwest Arkansas.
The website is graduatenwa.com and went public yesterday. This is Ozarks at Large.
150 years ago, Confederate General Theophilus Holmes fretted over the vulnerability of the Arkansas River Valley, the breadbasket of the state and the doorway to the state capital at Little Rock. To counter the potential threat, Holmes on September 28, 1862, ordered Naval Officer John W. Dunnington of the CSS Pontchartrain to develop fortifications on the Arkansas and White Rivers. Dunnington selected Arkansas Post, the state's first territorial capital and located on the first high ground in the lower Arkansas River, to be the first line of defense. Commandeering slaves from local plantations as laborers, Dunnington oversaw construction of what would become an impressive bastion called Fort Hindman, manned by sailors from the Pontchartrain, along with soldiers from Arkansas and Texas. To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. I'm Mark Crist.
It is Wednesday, September 19th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Crajeda.
We are inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, and with us is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And it's an All About Crystal Bridges day and a half. Tonight is the WOW event at Crystal Bridges for members and guests. A reminder in case you've forgotten or you have friends that you can tag along with. Food and drinks from 11 with Case
DeGuerro.
I always have trouble with his name. It starts at 6 o'clock, and you can find out more at crystalbridges.org. And tomorrow at 1 o'clock, a gallery talk that I will get to if I have to strangle somebody. It's called Edward Curtis and the Oklahoma Indian Tribes. And it's with Manuela Willoffman talking about the Edward Curtis photographs that they have on display.
All right.
Fascinating, fascinating stuff. 1 o'clock tomorrow, and it's free.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, September 19th, 2012. Friday night, the first performer in the 2012-2013 Starlight Jazz Series in Star Theater at Walton Arts Center will be on stage. Gretchen Parlato will perform at 7 and 9 o'clock. She was just announced as the Female Vocalist of the Year by the Jazz Journalists Association. Our own jazz man, Robert Ginsburg, who's the host of KUAF Shades of Jazz every Friday night at 10, recently talked with Gretchen by telephone. Here are excerpts of their conversation.
Congratulations, by the way, on this month's Jazz Journalist Association Award for the best female vocalist. It's got to be a great and well-deserved honor.
Thank you. It is. It sounds cliche, but it was a surprise. You know, anytime that kind of recognition is given, it's wonderful, and it was not expected, and it means a lot. You know, those are jazz journalists. You know, that's you guys. That's like what we are dependent on each other for what we do. So that feels good to receive that. Yeah.
You were the first vocalist ever to be admitted to the Thelonious Monk Institute, and I know you forged some really incredible alliances with other musicians attending the institute at the same time. Was that a pivotal moment in your career?
Oh, yeah. It's a two-year program, and they pick, you know, an ensemble, so it could be 5 to 7 musicians, and you are a band, and it's just kind of up to you, up to this group to figure out how to be a band without a leader. You know, there's not one person that's kind of calling the shots, and it really forces you to kind of analyze yourself, and kind of it makes you feel like you're in therapy for 2 years in a good way, in a way that might make people, there's always breakdowns and breakthroughs in that kind of situation where you're really learning about what you want to do in your life, what you want to do with your art, how you communicate with other people, what you want, what you don't want, and then it actually, because of that, the experience of traveling in that group, it made me realize that I had been in Los Angeles my entire life, and I love LA, and it's a wonderful place to be as an artist, but I knew that I needed to come to New York and really know what it would feel like to survive in this city. So after that, the Monk Institute, then I moved out here.
I've spoken to a lot of musicians who are also teachers and performers, and many of them have described that the most difficult thing in their development was to discover their own voice. Now, I know that you have acknowledged being influenced by singers who sound nothing like you, and I hear your voice is a very unique and instantly recognizable voice. Was it a struggle for you to find it?
That's a great question. I think when I was in that process, there were, you know, bumps in the road. I don't know if I would even call it a struggle, though, because I think I was always just doing what came naturally to me. And as soon as I wasn't, I felt it and I realized it, that wasn't working, you know. But I think I was always just singing in a pretty natural way. Or, like I say, if I was ever to just, you know, be imitating another singer or trying to sound like someone else, I could feel it literally in my voice, or just feel it in my whole being, that it's like, that's not quite working. that's not sitting well. That doesn't sound good. I would like to say that I've had a pretty realistic view, or realistic sense of an ear of what works with my voice and what doesn't. I would hope. I think that's a really huge part of being an artist, is to kind of know, you know, where you shine and what to do and what to not do, so to speak.
Holding back the years, thinking of the fear I've had so long. When somebody hears, listen to the fear that's gone.
You have 3 CDs now as a leader, most recently The Lost and Found, which came out last year, which you co-produced with Robert Glasper, and you wrote a lot of the music for that. Preceding that, in 2009, I think it was, you released In a Dream, and then your self-titled debut, which was in 2005. And additionally, as I looked into your career, I was amazed to see your active presence on no less than 45 CDs as a side person. It's interesting to observe I look at it as this rich gene pool of great artists that you're a part of. And there are notable associations that seem to be ongoing. You mentioned Lionel Luecke, Esperanza Spalding, Aaron Parks, Gregoire Marais, just to name a few. But can you describe the impact of your musical associations on you, and maybe from a wider perspective on the direction the music is going?
When I was in Los Angeles, but I have to say especially since I moved to New York, there's just a sense of such a community of musicians who all adore each other. We all respect each other at the highest level, and it really is like a family, and everybody is kind of, you know, intertwined, where they might work in different settings and configurations with each other, and if not work together, they at the very, you know, core of it, we support each other. So there's a sense of community and of support that I've never fallen into anything that's been competitive. It's like as soon as that's just not a game that I would play, and I really don't feel that with the people that I know and that I have been in touch with. You can tell when there's people that have played together and known each other their whole life and played together in different kind of groups. It's like you can hear the love and you can hear the humanity, and it makes the music much, much deeper and much higher.
Draw material for your recordings from a variety of sources and styles, including pop music and great jazz composers, and I know you're your love of Brazilian music has certainly influenced your choice of compositions. What do you find compelling in a composition that might trigger your desire to record it or to write something in that style?
Yeah, it might be something on the technical layer. It's a beautiful melody, really cool harmony, you know, just something in the musical aspect of the song that triggers something in me. Or then it might tap into like this other deeper level that I like to think of, which is the emotional one, which is, you know, everything that kind of gives you, that's connected to emotion, connected to feeling, and that maybe there's the lyrical content of the song that is incredible, the story of the song, mm-hmm. the whole message of it, or this other higher third level and layers, like the higher spiritual kind of level that is everything that you cannot really define, like the getting goosebumps when you hear something. The repertoire that I've built is it could come from any style of music. It's like a good song is a good song at the end of the day.
Mm. You know, I've admired your lyrics. They're very poetic, beautiful lyrics, and it seems like you're writing more and more music lately. Have you always aspired to compose?
I did, and I didn't really think that I could, and I didn't really tap into it until, late 20s and early 30s, really. The lyrics to Wayne Shorter's Juju were the first that I had attempted to write. So it's felt really good to open that up and to be inspired by all different things, you know, in my life, and realize that I can turn it into something that is poetic and artistic. Every experience, it can be the most, you know, heartbreaking ones to the most beautiful ones, and I've written about all of those, and I will continue to. I think that probably will always be my path of just writing about life, you know, life and our existence.
And if it makes me cry, I still love. Even if I don't know why, I still love. Even when things fall apart, I still love.
Very soon, September 21st, you'll be performing for the second time at the Walton Arts Center, but this time leading your own group. That's in Star Theater as actually the kickoff event for the 2012-2013 season, and I think you're the perfect person to kick the season off. Do you know who will be performing with you in the group?
I do. That's going to be Taylor Eichstee on piano and keyboard. On bass is Bernice Earl Travis, who's playing both acoustic bass and electric bass, and he's incredible. I mean, we've been touring together this last year, and he's kind of stepping it all up, adding the electric bass to the texture of the group, and he sings as well, so we're having a good time exploring different kind of territories with that. And then Mark Juliana on drums. So, and, you know, we've all played together. Referring back to the sense of a community, I've always had a lot of really very just incredible high level musicians. But we're looking forward to it. That specific group is going to be wonderful. We're playing this weekend actually in Switzerland, so we will be warmed up for you.
He was a winter wind, she was a summer flower.
Gretchen Parlato will perform twice Friday night at Walton Arts Center inside Star Theater. The first performance is at 7, the second is at 9 o'clock. She's the first performer in the 2012-2013 Starlight Jazz Series at Walton Arts Center. She talked with Robert Ginsberg, who is the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz, last week. This is Ozarks at Large.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
I'm so in love with you. This is no make-believe, got nothing up my sleeve. I'd die if you should leave. I I'm so in love with you.
Doyle and Teddy Wilburn, the Wilburn brothers, were born in Hardy, Arkansas in 1930 and 1931, respectively, to Benjamin and Katie Wilburn. Although Doyle and Teddy really made their mark as a duo, they got their start at ages 5 and 6 singing with the Wilburn family. There were two older brothers, Lester and Leslie, and an older sister named Geraldine. In 1940, the Wilburn family performed on the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, Tennessee. Doyle and Teddy weren't even teenagers. Father Benjamin Wilburn acted as agent, manager, promoter, and ticket seller for the group.
I wanna and I gotta and I wanna and I gotta get some of your love.
Established near the Arkansas-Missouri border, the Wilburn family group played Boot Hill area radio stations like KLCN in Blyville, Arkansas, and KWOC in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. The Wilburn family later recorded several singles for the label Four Star. In the late 1940s through the early 1950s, the four Wilburn brothers, without Sister Geraldine, who'd left to marry and return to Arkansas, had a show on KWKH in Shreveport, Louisiana. KWKH was home to the newly established Louisiana Hayride program. Hank Williams, Elvis Presley, and Arkansasers like the Browns, Floyd Kramer, Patsy Montana, and T. Texas Tyler helped establish themselves, and vice versa, by playing on the Louisiana Hayride. In 1951, Doyle and Teddy Wilburn were drafted for the Korean War. Webb Pierce filled their shoes with the remaining Wilburns. This helped establish the career of Webb Pierce, who became a country superstar. When Doyle and Teddy returned to the States, they toured with Webb Pierce and played guitar and bass on Pierce's first session for Decca Records. Webb Pierce with the Wilburn Brothers hit number 4 in 1954 with this next song called Sparkling Brown Eyes. It was really a duet with Pierce and Wilburn Brothers lead singer, Teddy. In 1954, Doyle and Teddy Wilburn signed with Decca Records themselves as the Wilburn Brothers, and the duo toured with Farron Young. In 1956, the Wilburn Brothers appeared on Arthur Godfrey's CBS TV show, toured with Ernest Tubb, and joined the Grand Ole Opry. Doyle and Teddy were barred from joining the Opry when they first sang there as young boys due to child labor laws. The sibling harmonies of the Sharp County, Arkansas natives were also heard on this top 10 hit from 1957 called Mr. Love with Ernest Tubb.
I'll see what I can do to bring her back to you.
Besides their dozens of chart hits, mainly from the late 1950s and mid-1960s, the Wilburn Brothers distinguished themselves in other ways in the music business. The pair were involved in publishing, booking, and artist representation. Their Sure Fire group published Loretta Lynn early in her career, and their agency negotiated her first contract with Decca Records. She later sued the Wilburns to get artistic freedom, but Lynn and the Wilburns were said to have eventually renewed their friendship. And by the way, don't confuse the Wilburn brothers with the Willis brothers, one of whom was born in Alex, Arkansas. The Willis brothers were the first to record with Hank Williams in 1946 and were born 10 or 15 years before the Wilburns. Anyway, ever on the edge, Doyle and Teddy Wilburn launched a country music television program in 1963, the first of its kind in color. The Wilburn Brothers' popular syndicated TV show helped expose new artists, including Loretta Lynn and Gene Shepherd. Doyle and Teddy's TV program ran until 1974 and featured their brothers Lester and Leslie as regulars. Through touring and other means, the Wilburn Brothers continued to develop new generations of country music talent. Patti Loveless also got early exposure thanks to the Wilburn Brothers, as did Loretta Lynn's youngest sister, Crystal Gayle, and others. Slightly 1 year older than Teddy, Virgil Doyle Wilburn, born July 7, 1930, died October 16, 1982, ending the Wilburn Brothers duo. The brothers had performed at the Grand Ole Opry the month before. More than 20 years later, Thurman Theodore Wilburn, born November 30, 1931, died on November 24, 2003, just shy of his 72nd birthday, with a public funeral held at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee. It was the same building where he and the Wilburn family had sang at the Grand Ole Opry before Teddy was even in double digits. He was a member of the Grand Ole Opry at his death. The Wilburn Brothers of Sharp County, Arkansas, charted songs from 1955 to 1972. That's the year this song hit the top 50. here in its entirety, is Arkansas, the 31st and final chart hit by Doyle and Teddy Wilburn, the Wilburn brothers of Hardy, Arkansas.
Though the brambles took the cabin I was born in, and the briars reclaimed the fields I used to plow, there's a yearning in my heart to be going to that 40-acre patch God sowed in sprouts. Arkansas, are your rivers still flowing? Is your cotton growing white as snow? Are the squirrels still a-barking up on old Crowley's Ridge? Has the girl I was sparking gone and burned another bridge? Arkansas. Arkansas. I have known the troubles I was born to know. I have wanted things a poor man's born to want. And in all my dreams and memories I go running through the fields of Arkansas from which I sprung. Arkansas, are your rivers still flowing? Is your cotton growing white as snow?
Do the young men still piddle with the thought of growing rich and slowly turn to old folks sitting
whittling on a stick? Arkansas. Arkansas.
Arkansas, the number 47 country hit from 1972 for Doyle and Teddy Wilburn, the Wilburn brothers from Hardy, Arkansas. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. As the election season begins to heat up, the League of Women Voters of Washington County tonight will look at what motivates people to vote, how participation rates have changed, and what type of information inspires citizens to go to the polls. During a panel discussion tonight, it will include a look at the ballot issues facing voters in November. It will begin at 5:30 this evening in the Walker Community Room in the Fayetteville Public Library. The event is open to the public and will be followed with an opportunity to ask questions. We'll have highlights from that panel on a future edition of Ozarks at Large.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, September the 19th, 2012. It's the birthday of William Golding, born in Cornwall, England, 1911. His first novel, also his best-known book, Lord of the Flies, written when he was working as a schoolteacher, rejected 21 times before a new editor at Faber & Faber in London decided to take a chance on it. It was on this date in 1940, a Polish soldier named Witold Pilecki allowed himself to be captured by the Nazis. He was a captain in the Polish resistance, and he wanted to find out what was going on near the town of Auschwitz. His superiors thought it was just a German camp for prisoners of war, but Pilecki suspected that something else was happening. So he joined a group of Polish citizens who were being rounded up by Nazis. Pilecki, leaving behind a wife and two young children, was taken to Auschwitz. He was given a number, 4859, and he soon realized that this was a Nazi death camp. He stayed there for 3 years. He smuggled out detailed reports of what was happening, reported on the gas chambers and the ovens to dispose of human remains. And his reports were so horrific that nobody in the Polish underground believed him. His reports made their way to the British and the Americans. He suggested ways to liberate the camp, but still nothing was done. Finally, in 1943, Pilecki, frustrated by the lack of action, faked a case of typhus. He escaped from the hospital. After the war, the Polish underground recruited him to spy on the Soviets, and he was captured by the Polish communist regime, executed for espionage in 1948. It was on this date, 1934, that Bruno Hauptmann was arrested for the kidnapping and murder of Charles Lindbergh's baby. He was convicted of the murder and executed on the basis of circumstantial evidence. His widow, Anna, spent the rest of her life trying to have the verdict overturned, but to no avail. And it was 30 years ago today, in 1982, a computer scientist named Scott Fallman first suggested the use of a colon, a hyphen, and a parenthesis to represent happy and sad faces, the first emoticons. Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dobbins, Cézanne's Seclusion. "I have begun to think," he wrote in a late letter, "that one cannot help others at all." This from a man who once called friendship the highest virtue. And in another he wrote, "Will I ever attain the end for which I have striven so long?" His greatest aspiration was certainty, yet his doubts made him blame himself wrongly, perceiving each painting a disaster. These swings between boldness and mistrust, intimacy and isolation, led him to stay at home, keep himself concealed, becoming a sort of hermit whose passion for the world directed every brushstroke, changed each creation into an expression of tenderness, which he dismissed, writing, "A vague sense of apprehension persists." Cézanne's Seclusion, a poem by Stephen Dobbins from his book Body Traffic, published by Penguin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The KUAF website is offering 2 3-day passes to the Yonder Mountain String Band's Harvest Music Festival, October 11th through the 13th in Ozark. Performers include Yonder Mountain String Band, Sam Bush, and more. Artist and musician-led family workshops will be offered, plus numerous vendors and outdoor activities. The drawing is Friday, September 28th, during Ozarks at Large at noon. Registration available right now at KUAF.com. As we mentioned earlier in the program, my co-host Antoinette Grajeda spending the morning in Bentonville today, where she was covering an announcement from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. They announced the Tyson Scholars of American Art, a Crystal Bridges residency program, as well as the beginning of the Don Tyson Prize. We'll have many more details about that announcement on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Mulberry. I'm Kyle Kellums for my co-host, Antoinette Grajeda. This is Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Christina Thomas will join me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy studio for tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll continue with our week-long series about poverty in Arkansas, that and the Crystal Bridges story, plus more tomorrow on Ozarks at Large and KUAF.